Oh yay, the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Thank you very much. Y'all can be seated, thanks. Welcome to the Third Court of Appeals. Justice Ellis and Crump and I welcome you here. We also want to welcome Magnolia Middle School and Principal Williams to the Third Court of Appeals as they are observing today. It's a pleasure to have y'all here as well. This is cause number 24789CV, Fair et al. Versus Powell et al. And if I could have counsels introduce yourself and announce whether you're ready or not for this appellate argument today. Welcome.
Good morning, Your Honor. Christopher Weber on behalf of the appellees and cross appellants and the present verdict.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Councils, as you know, this matter is being recorded and is presently live on our YouTube channel and will be available and recorded for you for viewing after this proceeding today. It'll be on the court's channel. In addition, my understanding is the parties, although this is a cross appeal, have announced that the appellants will be arguing for 15 minutes, the appellees will be arguing for 20 minutes, and then the appellants will take the last 5 minutes. Now, as the parties know, even though it's a cross appeal, you'll need to do all of your argument, both your cross arguments in that time frame. So typically that is not our order of time frame allocation when we have cross appeals, but I think the parties understand what I'm saying with regard to having your entire argument within those time allocations. The green light means you've got your time allocation. Yellow means you have 2 more minutes left, so start wrapping up your thoughts. The red light means that your time is up. Certainly, if you've got a question pending from myself or my colleagues, we'll certainly allow you grace to conclude that argument. With that, I'm going to tender the floor to Ms. Scrivener-Tibbs and hear from the appellants. Thank you. Yes, ma'am, I can. Thank you very much. And if you could keep your voice up, especially since we've got students in the room that are interested in hearing what you have to say. Two causes of action. First,
slander of title and tortious interference with a contract. The court was not presented with any credible evidence to establish counterclaims damages, so the amount of damages is zero. She stated that for both causes of action. Then the problem is in the next paragraph, the court went on further to state, in addition to the primary damages, which I'm not really sure what that means, which were zero, they were zero in this case, the tortious interference and slander of title incurred additional costs to having to maintain ownership of the property after the loss of sale. The way that she stated that, Judge, made us believe that she was trying to create an idea of loss of sale of property as a cause of action. It was not a cause of action. As a matter of fact, if you look at the pleadings, he pled for slander of title and tortious interference with the contract. And in that, as part of his damages and recovery, he had alleged that he had lost the sale, and that's what he said was his damages. Now, the reason why it's inconsistent on his face is because of the fact that you can't say at the beginning that under those two causes of actions, slander and tortious interference of contract, that there's no credible evidence of damages. And then in the following paragraph, you go and you assess damages. And they did that in this case. And she actually assessed damages for quite a bit of money. She assessed damages for the money. And I apologize for my eyes. I can't see that, but I need my glasses or not. So she's fairly familiar. So she had damages of $59,164.23. And how she calculated damages is not the correct standard for determining damages.
Did you, I noticed that you did not respond, the appellant did not respond in briefing to any of the damage arguments by the appellee. Does that have any bearing on the court's analysis of your argument here today? Is there any waiver on your part because of not raising any counter-briefing?
I don't believe so, Judge, because fundamentally what we believe is that because of the theory of justification, if it was taken into account, then he never could have gotten the issue of damage.
How was your justification argument timely in that your justification argument was raised after the second motion for summary judgment was filed and already heard and ruled upon?
The court did state that at the time, and she asked me specifically when we were in court, why didn't we raise it previously? And I explained to her that we did raise the concept in our motion for summary judgment. It may not have been clearly stated, but it was referred to.
And where was that specifically?
That was in our, we actually filed it in our response to the motion for summary judgment.
So a response, not, okay, response to the motion for summary judgment. Is this the second motion?
Yes, it was the second motion for summary judgment.
And you, do you know Paige?
I do not know.
Okay. All right, thank you. And I apologize for getting you off track. Go ahead.
So basically.
And was it in your pleadings at that time, or was it just in your response to the summary judgment? Had you pled it?
We pled it shortly thereafter. We did plead it in our response to his counterclaim. And we also let it and referred to it again on reconsideration.
Thank you. Thank you.
May I address the issue of the court's finding related to no evidence or no credible evidence with respect to what you just addressed before the questions. There was evidence that supported, though, The damages that were awarded specifically related to maintenance, insurance, and note payments. That was in evidence, correct?
He provided information during the hearing on that particular issue. And at the time, I objected to that as well, because the under, and I will get the name of the case, but there is, Farrell versus Farrell cited it at the time. It says that is not the correct damage model. Okay, in that court, the court stated that the damages are actually the amount of actual damages caused by the slander of contract is generally the difference between the contract price, the amount the plaintiff would have received, but for the defendant's title of disparagement and the property's market value and the time of the trial when the cloud was removed. So to sit there and argue that, you know, notes for the payment, the taxes, and the insurance, that is not the correct damage model to begin with. But we also feel that really shouldn't even have gotten to that point. I thought what was really interesting, too, about her order that she entered in the final judgment, I think at some point she realized that justification was a specific defense that could have been, you know, could have been accepted and would bar his claim for damages. I think that's why she got the zero determination. If you look on in her judgment, she says plaintiff claims for affirmative relief already have been resolved and denied. She did allow me to assert it, reconsider it at the time right before we went into trial. She did allow me to do that. But in this particular order, she doesn't even say what the affirmative defense was. Now, when we prepared the orders, and we both of us, we submitted our sample orders, our findings of fact, I noticed that all reference to the idea and the legal theory and affirmative defense was just totally eliminated. It's nowhere in the record except what I have supplied. And so that is very concerning to me. I mean, the bottom line is it is a significant affirmative defense which was completely ignored. And the reason why it bothers me so deeply is because of the fact these people had a dispute over an easement. My client lived on that property for almost 20 years. It was in a being split in a marriage agreement, okay? They were dissolving their marriage, they lived apart for a number of years, and that was a part of the property that she got. Now this property was a fairly large piece of property, but it's so intertwined, you know? They had a roadway which they had used for years to go to the house.
But don't you still have to look at whether it was necessary? And because of the Caliche roadway, was it in fact necessary? Because that's what the Supreme Court has said, is you have to look at the necessity of it, regardless of whether it was used before or not. You have to look at whether it was necessary. And since there was another path to a public road, it was not necessary. And that's where the Supreme Court has focused.
I understand that, Judge, but the issue is, okay, number one, when we first got on the case, and it was initially brought in for Mrs. Fair, okay? This was actually the position of her prior counsel, Ms. Necessity. Upon review, we noticed that she probably had a better claim for a unity of ownership. Because she had, she could have established through the evidence that she had unity of ownership and had continuous use for 20 years. And that was also something else that was not considered. And
but if that wasn't in front of the trial judge, so that's not in front of us. So what we have is what the Supreme Court's looking at in Hamrick versus Ward, which is necessity. And so if necessity rules the day in this case, she had a method to get to a public road, correct?
Well, a couple of things. It's a factual issue and there's a legal issue, okay, and I'll address both. The practical issue is this. The roadway, which was, because one was just a path. It was a dirt path. I've been out on the property many times. And it's significantly further away from the commercial facility. That's the only commercial facility in that particular area, you know, so that's why it's such a prized place to own, okay? So basically, where the event center is located, it's just a few, maybe two football fields away from the event center. The other pathway is like on, it has a drainage ditch, it's a dirt path, that people basically just traveled up and down that particular road, okay? So when you say, oh, she had another way to go, it was not really another feasible way to go to a commercial building. Now, they have stated in their brief that, you know, that they had talked to the city and that they said that they never made a determination that she couldn't use it for commercial use. But they failed to disclose the fact that they had another city manager there who she had that conversation with who told her that. And the problem is that down her dirt road, they had made this whole big development over there, right? And in this development, they put all these new houses, and when she would travel or attempt to travel down that dirt road and throw up all the dust, they were complaining to the city, okay? So they blocked that, okay? That was one problem. Now, on the legal issue of necessity, what we're arguing on this point, Judge, at this particular point in time, is the fact that if, under the theory of justification, okay, you have the right to go in and assert your legal claim. Now, an easement can be established in writing, and it also could be an implied easement. And she could have used several theories. They try to bring in the argument that she didn't even have a valid legal claim, but she did. You know, she believed that she did. She went to an attorney. The attorney said, she's like, well, I've had this for all this time. Why can't I still use it? He said, well, these are some of the legal theories that we can apply to try to get you access to the road. So, and that is very important because under the theory of justification, under that particular theory, he's trying to argue that maybe that the lawsuit that she brought was frivolous, or that caused tortious interference. Now, if you bring a legal claim.
And you'll need to wrap up.
Excuse me?
And you'll need to wrap up. It does come quickly, doesn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, the bottom line is that under the theory of justification, nothing should have occurred, okay? It should not have occurred, the decision should not have been made, attorney's fees should have been granted because there is no attorney's fees on tortious interference and slander of title, which is the only way he could have supported his loss for damages under a loss for survival.
And I'll put a pin in that because I believe the attorney's fees was on the deck action, so we'll talk about that in your rebuttal. So let me visit with the appellee. Yes, counsel.
Good morning, Chief Justice Byrne, Justice Trump, Justice Ellis, and please the court.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to start by examining some recent Texas Supreme Court cases that dealt with easements. This case basically had three components, and it just so happens that the very similar judgments dealt with the first two components, and then the last component, the damages, was dealt with the trial. The first component of the case, the first component for this court, and the first component that was addressed in our first summary judgment, was the issue of whether there's an easement. The second component was there liability for Ms. Fair's interference with my client's use of their property, their ability to sell that property. And that's the second component that we'll deal with today. And then the last, of course, was damages.
And certainly I would like for you to address her argument about the incongruence of the judgment when she argues that there is no evidence of damages, but you got damages, and that being incongruent, and the damages being the mortgage payments and the interest and things of that nature.
Would you like me to address that now?
Do you mind? I really do want to get to that issue.
Okay. I believe the case that controls that is the Capital Title versus Donaldson case, which is mentioned probably somewhere around page 31 or 32 of our cross-appellant's opening brief. And in that one, it says that there was sufficient evidence of actual damages to support the jury's award, and that evidence included, one, the difference in the contract price of the original and subsequent contracts, less the fees saved for closing, survey, inspection, broker's commission, and title policy. Two, and here's the one that I believe answers your question, Justice Byrne, two, the taxes unable to be saved by rolling sellers' capital gains from the sale of the house into the purchase of a new house. Three, an estimate of the interest paid on the house note. Four, attorney's fees and court costs. And five, the approximate amount of interest the seller could have made from the investment from the property itself. So there is case law that supports that there's other damage components that can be considered, despite my learned friend's insistence to the opposite. Okay, with that in mind, if I could, I'd like to address those easement cases and just kind of get that out of the way.
Certainly.
There's been about 10 cases on easements that the Texas Supreme Court has addressed while this case has been pending. Of those 10, there are three that I believe kind of get close to touching the easement issues in this case, and so I'd like to identify those and differentiate them. The first is Albert versus Fort Worth and Western Railroad Company. It was decided on November 17th, the decision came down, I believe it was in February of 2024. The other two were issued on December 31st of 2024. I believe this one can be distinguished because in the Albert versus Fort Worth and Western Railroad Company, the use of the easement there was it was an easement by prescription, which was one of the claims made in this matter. But in the Albert versus Fort Worth case, the court found that there was an exclusivity. Another, keep in mind, of course, for the easement by prescription, it follows the rules for adverse possession, and so you have to have the five elements, one being exclusivity, and there was exclusivity in this case. There was not exclusivity in the Fair versus Powell case. Everybody was using that roadway for a period of time. And then the other factor why the Albert versus Fort Worth case does not apply in this matter is because there was an agreement, so there's no there was no adversity, as would be required here. The agreement was that 2019 agreement that I happen to be the primary author of, that allowed Mrs. Fair to use that roadway in front of what at that time was her strange husband's, I guess you might say, property, that later became my client's property. And because Ms. Fair's use of that property was with permission, there was no adversity. So that's why the Albert versus Fort Worth case can be distinguished. The second, and this is the one that's most concerning to me, is the 425 Soledad Limited versus CRVI Riverwalk case. What happened in this case is the Supreme Court found that there was, in fact, an easement that the tenants of the 425 Soledad building, an office building in San Antonio, could make use of, even though it wasn't written, wasn't reported. The owner of the parking garage that was at issue claimed that they weren't aware of the use by the 425 tenants. There's a couple of ways that this one needs to be differentiated. First of all, in the 425 Soledad case, there was no written agreement. There was no termination of that agreement. It was just something that the earlier owners of the property had done basically a handshake deal with them, and the tenants of the 425 building became accustomed to it. In the Fair versus Powell case, the one before the court today, there was a written agreement, and it terminated mid-year of 2020. End of story. It was that January 1st, 2019 agreement that had an 18-month time span, and then it was very clear, and it said, we're done. And the second is that unlike the Hemrick versus Ward case that you mentioned a moment ago, Chief Justice Byrne, mm-hmm. Hemrick versus Ward had to do with a roadway. And what Hemrick versus Ward says is that when you're dealing with roadways, because they're so burdensome on the servient property, that they have to be given special treatment. And the exclusivity, or I'm sorry, the necessity has to be strict. And there was no strict necessity here. That Caliche path did exist, and that kind of reminds me, there's something else I would like to bring to the attention of the court that's unique about this case. Typically, when you have a situation where you have black acre and you're severing it into track A and track B, either track the entire black acre parcel becomes owned by perhaps person C, person B and person C, in other words, different parties than the original owners, or sometimes the original owner may keep track A, and the original owner being A, and then the severed portion goes to a stranger to the property. Here we don't have that. What's unique about this particular case is Black Acre was owned by Mr. and Mrs. Fair jointly. When they severed the property, Mrs. Fair was severing property she already owned. She was aware at that time of the access to and from the property. She had owned it, as Ms. Tibbs just said, for decades, which means she knew that if she needed to get access using what now has become the Powell's Roadway, that she should have reserved that in that conveyance at that time. So why didn't she? The reason she didn't is because she knew she had the Caliche Road going in the other way.
So I have a question about so Ms. Scrivener Tibbs mentioned that there was a city manager person who said that she was not able to use the Caliche Road for commercial purposes. If that was the case, would that give rise to a good faith belief that she could use the paved road?
That's, actually that in my notes to go into. What happened is that allegation was made. We researched it. We met with the city engineering people and everything else and got a letter saying that there was no amendment. That letter, of course, was admissible because it was a government document. And so it was admitted. If there was some predecessor person who said, oh, you can't use that Caliche Road, that person's testimony was never offered, they were never presented before the court, that evidence was, there was no evidence of that brought to the attention of the court at trial level whatsoever. In fact, today is the first day that I'm hearing that it was somebody else. So certainly there was the opportunity, if that had happened, to bring some evidence of that before the trial court, and it simply didn't happen. The record is devoid of it.
May I follow up with that question? I also heard from Ms. Scrivener Tibbs some evidence about, or allegations about, the new homes being built and complaints related to dust and debris being, I guess, shooting up when people drive on the Caliche Road. Was that considered by the court or not?
I don't believe it was, because the case law that discusses those types of issues makes clear that basically if there's a walking path that can be used to get onto the property, then there's no necessity. This Caliche Road could have been paved. There's case law, and it's mentioned in our brief, that talks about roads that were used that created the lack of necessity, that demonstrated that there was no necessity, that even went through ravines, and even that was good enough. So Ms. Fair could have paved that road if she wished to, instead of spending all this money on litigation. But it's clear that there was no necessity. Which is sort of odd about this case, too, because when it was first filed, the first we were told is, well, this is the only way that Ms. Fair and her guests can come onto the property. Well, what's strange about that is at the time the case was filed, people had been coming on to that property from the Caliche Road that goes out to Keeneland, the other entrance, for about a two-year period. And then when we pointed out to the trial court that there is this other way, well, then the story switched. It's not that it's a Caliche Road, that it's not that it's necessity any longer. Now it is, well, the city council told us we couldn't use it. We went to city council and got the letter from Fair Oaks saying we've never told Ms. Fair she can't use that road. And it's mentioned in our brief as well that that particular parcel was accepted from the residential restrictions that were in the restrictive covenants applicable to the rest of the tract. So
to follow up on that about paving the road, Was there any discussion about any kind of type of hindrance or anything that would have prevented the road from being paved? Any discussion about that?
That was never brought up at trial court. I think the closest that plaintiff got to that was it was an objection over the expense amount. It was going to be expensive to do it. But that's not the law. The law doesn't look at whether it's expensive or not. It just simply looks to, is there a way that you can get from Blackacre onto a public roadway? And the answer here clearly is yes. So we switched the argument, plaintiff switched the argument from we have no access, so we need an easement by necessity, to, well, we have an access, but the city won't let us use it. And then once we brought the letter in from the city saying we've never told Ms. Fair that she can't use it, then the argument was, well, we did this all in good faith. It was all, we're justified. But Justice Ellis, I'm sorry, Justice Burns, you had mentioned, that argument was raised far too late. It wasn't raised in any of the responses to the summary judgment. In fact, when it was raised, was at a hearing when I would not have had a fair opportunity to have disproven that. We've had to cobble together evidence from depositions and from pleadings and things to even respond to that allegation in our briefs.
And counsel, to kind of segue from that for just a second and talking about what's in the record and what's not in the record, with regard to your damages argument, segueing a little bit, there's an Exhibit 9 in your cross-appeal brief, the 2024 appraisal value of $674,700. Is that in the trial court record?
It's not.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we can't consider that?
Probably not. The only reason I put it in there is I wanted to be able to demonstrate to the court that once these issues were determined that the price was stabilized and did in fact come to the price that Mr. Powell had testified about during trial.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure that is something that's outside the record.
It
okay.
is outside the record.
Okay. Thank you.
And final case from the Texas Supreme Court, that I just wish to bring to the court's attention today is Keenan versus Robin. This also was decided on December 31st of 2024. That case did find that there was an easement, an unreported okay, but it was over a public roadway. And of course, here we're not dealing with a public roadway, which obviously cannot be interfered with. You can't interfere with somebody's use of a public roadway. It was public. Here we're not dealing with a public roadway. In the Fair versus Powell case, we're dealing with a private. It's a long drive. Several hundred yards, but it's still a driveway, and it's still a driveway. So that's why Keenan versus Robin, I don't think, would be applicable to this case either. So in other words, the cases that are cited in the brief are still good law, and the more recent law doesn't change anything from, for example, Hammer versus Wood. With regard to damages, I'll just finish up the easement argument. With regard to the easement argument, I think that Judge Bascone's determination that there was no easement was a correct one. Under Texas law, Ms. Fair did not have an easement. In fact, one of the things that we did during argument before the trial court was we went through all of the various types of easements that are recognized by Texas law and the elements required for each one, and we couldn't establish any kind of easement based on doing that. So I think Judge Bascone's determination was correct. With regard to damages, there's two areas where we believe we should have been awarded damages and we're not. And they do overlap. And we wanted to give the trial court the ability to choose one or the other, or maybe a combination of both. But of course, a double recovery is not possible. But the first, of course, was for damages for tortious interference with contract. That issue is addressed at page 31 of our cross-appellant's open brief. And what is very clear is, and this is from the Paula case, P-A-L-L-A, that's mentioned in the brief, it's Paula versus Bio One Inc., Dallas case from 2014. The measure of damages is the difference between the contract price and the market value of the property. The contract price was $2.1 million. That's what Mr. and Mrs. Powell could have sold this tract for if Ms. Fair had not interfered with them. But because of her interference, because of the lawsuit having been filed, improvidently, that created a loss of that sale, and so the difference was between roughly the $500,000 market value of the property and the $2.1 sale price, less, of course, the outstanding mortgage.
I have a question about that. What specific statements did Ms. Fair make to the potential buyers?
It's kind of an interesting chronology that happened in there. When Ms. Fair first learned that Mr. and Mrs. Powell had purchased the property, her attorney at the time reached out to the Powell's attorney at the time and said, we'd like to negotiate a new access agreement because the one that had been negotiated between Mr. Fair, the prior owner, as a separate property, and Ms. Fair was about to expire. I think it had like a week or so to go. And so some initial discussions were had regarding a new license agreement. The Powells didn't hear back from Ms. Fair or from her attorney for almost 2 years. And it wasn't until Ms. Fair found out that the Powells had received a $2.1 million offer, she decided she would, for lack of a better way to say it, muscle her way into the easement she wanted by saying, I'm going to sue you, and I have sued you, and if you want the suit dismissed, just give me that easement. And then once I get the easement, then I'll dismiss my lawsuit. If that's not trying to muscle your way into getting an easement that you don't deserve, I don't know what could be.
Were those statements made to the potential buyers?
Those statements were made in an email from Ms. Fair's attorney to the Powell's attorney at that time. And I believe the email was brought, it is in evidence before the court.
So not to the potential buyers?
Justice Ellis, you're right. That those same statements or similar statements were made by Ms. Fair and her counsel to the prospective buyers. And some negotiations were had about, you know, I'd like to have an easement. The buyers said, well, we're not willing to give you one. And so the deal cratered, especially when the lawsuit was filed. The buyers were then able to use the lawsuit exemption, pending litigation exemption in the earnestment contract, and they were able to cancel the contract and give the earnestment.
If we agree with you that there was error in the judgment related to damages, are you asking for this court to render or to remand back to the trial court to decide damages?
I think you could render because certainly there's enough evidence in the record. And let me just tell you why I think Judge Bestrom, and this is just rank speculation, but why I think Judge Bestrom did what she did. Gabrielle Powell, one of my clients, is the granddaughter of Ms. Fair, and as the panel can probably see, the family is somewhat split. We have the Powell side of the family to my right, the Fair side of the family and their supporters to the left. I don't want to say it's a horrible split. I've seen worse. I do some family law, but there is a divide between the family. And I think what Judge Gascon was attempting to do is maybe split the baby in a way that would this appeal. You know, I'm going to say there's no easement. I'm going to say that we're going to get you your attorney's fees back, but hopefully, you know, there's not enough here for either party or the other to insist on going forward with an appeal. And in fact, my instructions were do not appeal unless Ms. Fair appeals first. And that's why cross appeal was filed. My clients believed that they were entitled to greater damages, but we didn't want to push the issue. We were just glad to be out of the trap, if you will. But here we are.
May I ask you one more question going back to the potential buyers? So is it your belief that, so they were past their option period to get out of the contract, and so the only way they could get out was because this lawsuit was filed. And so you believe that regardless of whether or not Ms. Fair made any disparaging statements or threatened to sue the potential buyers for easement, that because she filed the lawsuit, that gave them the out.
There was a period of time during which the lawsuit was still on file and the contract was still pending, and the buyer was saying, hey, see if you can get this resolved so that we can continue and finish mm-hmm. the contract. But Ms. Fair was unwilling to dismiss unless she got her easement.
Thank you. And I'll give you a moment to kind of wrap up your thoughts.
Unless the panel has any more questions for me, I think I've gotten everything out that I wanted to get out. I appreciate it. Counsel's questions and the opportunity to speak to
you. Thank you so much, counsel. And let me hear from the appellants for rebuttal. Yes, ma'am.
Point of correction on misrepresentation of some of the facts. Initially, my client had filed with another counsel also a temporary restraining order. because she did have that event center. She had someone working there, and they had planned weddings there. And they had put up a fence, and this is in the record, put up a fence and blocked her use of it. And they had planned weddings. That's why she filed the lawsuit. Additionally, one of the other misrepresentations was she did not contact the buyer. The buyer contacted her. Because not only did he want to buy her property, he wanted to buy Ms. Baird's property. Ms. Baird is extremely attached to that property. She leaves an inheritance for her family, and she wanted to keep it. Now, the bottom line is that she did not want to sell the property, so they started negotiating with her attorney to try to get some kind of resolution to either buy it or give her a right of first refusal. That's what they've been negotiating about. She did not file a lawsuit because, you know, she was trying to somehow get them to breach the contract or get out of the contract or tortiously interfere with the contract. And even when he gave his discussion about this, tortious interference, if you have a legitimate dispute, you believe that you own an easement. You were told by an attorney that you had a right to an easement. You have a legal right to at least go to court. And if there's an implied easement, you talk about all these cases that have come up since this time. You know, where else could she go to get a resolution on the issue of the easement? And it was not them that said, hey, we're grown up, we're not going to do anything. After they took their deposition, while the case was still pending, we tried to reach out to them and say, look, we're not going to break up the family for this. Let's try to reason with this. A few days later, he goes and files a counterclaim. And that's when he started attacking Mrs. Fair. The bottom line is under justification, and you know, there's nothing new under the sun. Under Restatement Tort Section 772, it says improper motives cannot transfer lawful actions into actionable torts. Whatever a man has a legal right to do, he may do it with impunity, regardless of motive. If an exercise of a legal right in a legal way results in another, no cause of action arises against him because of a base motive in exercising the right. The bottom line is you can sit there and you can comb through this record. This woman didn't do anything to interfere with the buyer. The buyer contacted her. There was no tortious interference with the contract, and all the actions that she took were protected by the law. You know, if you cannot go to a court to resolve a dispute, where can you go? It's justification. It should not get any money for it. She was protected to try to go to someone who could make a determination that she could legally rely on.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. The court appreciates your time and your arguments, and this case will be submitted, and the court does stand in recess. Thank you, counsels.